Good morning. Great to see everybody here. We're going to continue our study of 1 Samuel 1 through 10, probably get through at least most of it, if not all of it. We'll see if we even get into the next lesson as well. But as we are moving out of the judges into the United Kingdom, we saw last week in our overview, or last class in our overview, that we have the last two judges, Eli and Samuel. We have the downfall of Eli and his household. We have the rise of Samuel, and then the request for a king. And God selects Saul, and we're going to see kind of how he plays out over the next two workbook lessons, and then we'll, of course, move into David full throttle when we get to 2 Samuel. So as we continue our study, I think we got down to about number three and about halfway through this, and I would note here, as you can see on the screen, that it's interesting that the progressive blindness of Eli seems to represent his failed spiritual sight. He just is continuing to spiral downward, and he has given an empty rebuke to his sons, but it is, as it talks about, his eyes being heavy. He can't see what's going on. He can't see the battle. He's curious about the ark. We see what is happening to that household and why God has promised that he's going to destroy the household of Eli and raise up a priest after his own heart. So as we think about 1 Samuel chapter 3, who won the war between Israel and the Philistines? The Philistines do. Yeah. You know, we anticipate as we watch through the history of Israel, you know, God should be with them. Israel should be winning all their victory, all their wars, and what we see is as they move farther and farther away from God, his presence is no longer with them, his strength is no longer with them, and even the ark is just a token now. It's not really representing his presence because he has abandoned his people because of their abandonment of him. I think Stephen may have brought up, or someone may have brought up in one of the classes recently, that it looks an awful lot like what the nations look like in Romans chapter 1, that they abandon God, he allows them to do so. He gives them up to their own devices. How does the name of the grandson of Eli exemplify the result, this loss of the war? First of all, what is the name of Eli's grandson? Ichabod. And what does that mean in Hebrew? Glory has departed. Kavod is the word for glory. And so you have that, see that at the end, ik kavod. And so you have that, the glory has departed. And so this daughter-in-law of Eli seems to have better spiritual insight, as she is seeing the results of everything that is happening. As the ark has been taken away, she sees that God's glory has departed. And this is going to be a theme that is echoed throughout the Old Testament. Can you think of any story in the future from the time of the judges where we see God's glory departing? From the temple.
In the destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah, in the destruction of Jerusalem. And you kind of even see that, I'm thinking specifically in the vision of Ezekiel, where you see that progression of the glory leaving. Then you see, again, kind of a hope of the glory returning. I think we see that also in the New Testament, because does anyone remember just before Matthew 24, at the end of chapter 23, as Jesus is talking about the prophets they're killing, the Jews going to kill Jesus himself, what does he say about the house? Your house is left to you desolate. That means it's empty. And I think the picture here is that God's glory is departing from the temple, and now it is ripe for judgment. So when AD 70 comes, God's presence is no longer there, and the temple can be destroyed. He has abandoned that place. In fact, it is now your house, Jesus says. Your house is left to you desolate. God is not claiming that anymore. He has built a new temple, which may have some echoes, where you have the priesthood, where God is departing, and then he's going to raise up his own priesthood and his glory will return. See that same thing with the temple in the Old Testament, Ezekiel. You're seeing it again in the New Testament as well. And Stephen pointed out that I do think there is that verbal connection in Mark where you have the heavens split open, and then you have the Holy of Holies split open, if you will, at the death of Jesus. And I think there's kind of a dual meaning there. Stephen pointed out the positive sense of now we have access to the presence of God. I think there's also a negative concept that is kind of alluded to in Matthew and maybe Luke a little bit, is that when that veil split, God's glory is departing from that physical temple, and now it is into heaven itself that people have access. And so we're seeing these echoes all the way through the Old Testament, on into the New Testament. Glory is associated with the presence of God, and when it departs, judgment always comes. All right, any questions about this battle between Israel and the Philistines? All right, then let's go on to question number four, section number four here with all these questions. So in chapter five, we get kind of a little aside where you learn about what happens to the ark after it's been taken away. So we leave Israel for a time. We focus in a new setting in Philistine territory. And the Philistines brought the ark where?
To Ashdod.
Now, Ashdod is going to come up frequently. It's associated with as a Gentile city, of a Philistine city. In fact, when we get to the period of the return, we're going to see that the children were speaking the language of Ashdod, so they're not even speaking their own native tongue. And that may be part of how Ezra, as he is reading the law and the men there are giving the interpretation of it, it may not just be explaining this is how you apply it. It may be that there may be some translation going on where they're having to translate to these people who have abandoned their mother tongue of Hebrew. And so you have this Ashdod is associated with Philistine territory, associated with Gentiles. The ark is in Gentile territory. And that would just cause the heart of a Jew to drop, to know that the ark is no longer with the people of God. Now, how did the Philistine god Dagon react to the ark being in his place?
Well, he came in the morning, poor Dagon had fallen over. Mm-hmm. Next day, he fell over again.
Yes. Yes. What does that symbolize? Okay, worship. We've got Dagon falling, bowing down before Yahweh, or the representation of Yahweh's footstool, the ark. Anything else with the hands and head falling off?
Power and authority
has been taken away. God is visually representing to these Philistines that his presence is going to be the downfall of their gods. And so that would have, that does move them to do something new, because they recognize the power of Yahweh in the presence of Dagon. Any additional thoughts on that? Kevin?
You've got to think some people who were superstitious enough to worship a rock would be superstitious enough to be permanently influenced by this happening.
Yes. Yeah, we may see some minor change, and you get the threshold discussion there a little bit. But yeah, they don't convert by any means to Yahweh.
Well, it's the mentality is a competitive mentality. Our God versus your God, and so it's just like the God of the Hills mentality. Okay, bringing your God in here was not a good idea, right? Mm-hmm. Versus your God is the true God.
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of reminds me that you see echoes of that kind of mentality among Gentiles all through the Old Testament. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, you see some maybe growth. Don't know if it's growth or not, but you see some change in his assumptions. And that this was the world, not only of the Old Testament, but also the New Testament, of the gods of the nations. In fact, Jews were viewed as atheists because they believed in one God and excluded all other gods. And so in these Gentile nations, they would have been okay with, sure, you Israelites can have a God, but don't deny these other gods. And we're seeing the superiority of Yahweh, that he is the one and only God. He is superior in every way to these other gods. Right? Any additional thoughts? All right, then what did God then do to the Philistines? Not only have their God bow down, but what happens next? What's that? Mm-hmm. Very good. So we have these tumors that come upon them, a plague of sorts that comes upon the Philistines. And what do the Philistines decide to do after that? Yes, it's not worth it. We got to get rid of this ark. We got to get rid of this God. Now, they recognize, now, this could be the God of Israel, or this could be happenstance. How do we find out if it's really God or if it's not? What plan do they come up with? Mm-hmm. Yes. And what happens? We just get recurrence of things happening. And so then they decide, well, here is how we will know if it is really the God of Israel who's doing this. What did they do?
Built a new ark that they had to put on there, put the symbols of the things that had in there. But then they separated the nursing calf from their mother.
Mm-hmm.
So as they attached the cart with the ark on it, it went down the road to Bethshemesh. They knew that those cows were blowing their calf. That's a very, very strong. They'll break down fences to get to each other. Here they just walk away.
Excellent. So they come up with a plan to figure out if this is just natural, then you're going to have the natural occurrence of the cows are not going to go to Israel, but they do. And so that shows that there's something supernatural happening here. There's something different. And so they assume this must be the God of Israel. They're right. And it goes on to Beth Shemesh. All right. Now, you mentioned the new cart, which answers the how did the Israelites transport the ark back to Israel. Let's just kind of put a bookmark here, because what Israelite king would later use this same method to move the ark? David. And how did that turn out? It's not going to turn out well at all. We're going to see that in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where we have them transporting by this new cart instead of by the means by which God had chosen, and we're going to see God's judgment come upon them. All right. Any additional thoughts here on chapter 5? All right. Then as we continue on in section number 5, the people of Israel slowly turn from their wickedness, as we get into chapter 6 and 7, to serve the Lord. They remove their idols and follow Samuel as their judge. What does God do to their enemies, the Philistines? As you read chapter 7, verses 7 through 14, what does God do to them? Absolutely. Very good. And so we're going to put a supernatural blockade against the Philistines. They're going to lose battles and they're not going to come in anymore. They're going to see the power of Yahweh with the ark. They're going to see the power of Yahweh with the prophet Samuel leading the people as a judge, as a military leader. And they are no longer going to attempt at this point to come in. Now we're going to see that they maybe see that the power has lessened with the next administration when we get to Saul, because they're going to have some battles between the Philistines, and then we're going to see that continues on with David, and David is going to be the one who rises up against the Philistines.
Just a commentary on the thunder being loud enough to confuse. When I was a kid, I didn't understand that. But I went to a tractor pull, and that was an uninteresting experience, having something just volume, and he knew what it was, and you were expecting it. But the sensation was confusion.
Yes. Excellent. Any other thoughts? All right, moving on to section 6 here. As we've kind of looked at the first 7 chapters and we've discussed Eli and Samuel, I just want to get some feedback from you. What do you see as comparisons, contrasts between Eli and Samuel and Eli and Samuel's children? Let's start with Eli and Samuel. As you kind of look at it in broad strokes, what do you see as the major differences between these two priest judges?
Samuel stayed loyal to God all the way to the end, whereas Eli
mm-hmm. not realizing what's going on around him, slowly allowing himself to fall to the level of really the people.
Excellent. Very good. Any other thoughts on Eli and Samuel?
Just Samuel's speech gives us that picture of his personal integrity that he maintained. And so whatever failures of his children, you know, as Chris said, he doesn't partake in that. And Eli seems to, at least at some level, turn a blind eye and partake of the weakness of his sons.
Yes. Yeah, that was a point I definitely wanted to draw out because Eli is said to have grown fat on the sin of his sons, if you will, and thus you get that picture of heaviness all the way through. I thought it might be a little too snarky, but I think maybe there is intentional wordplay in 1 Samuel that the word heavy, that Eli was heavy, is kabod, glorious, heavy. And so you have some interesting wordplay there between he's grown fat on the sin of his sons, and he has become glorious, heavy, with that, and then suddenly God's glory is going to depart. And so it's interesting, maybe a little bit of wordplay there between heaviness of Eli and the glory, the heaviness of God that is now departing. Any additional? So the sons were brought up. Do you see similarities or differences between Eli and Samuel's sons?
Set of sons walked in the ways of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
They were both guilty of sins that were pretty obvious.
Yes, very good. Same thing?
Yeah, same thing. Just they both chose for taking their positions to use worldly gain.
Mm-hmm.
For, I think, I've been noticing some TV evangelists today, that's all you hear when you turn on that station is send us money.
Yes.
And so they made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like both dads, we don't have a lot of information on Samuel. What his actions were,
you're right. We don't have a lot of information there, but we do see an echo of the judges, don't we? That there would be a good generation, then a generation arises that does not know the Lord. Stephen, did you have something?
Yeah, just that. You know that language is they do not walk in your ways. So.
Mm-hmm.
There's a distinction, a clearer distinction in
yes.
their departure as opposed to, you know, sons mm-hmm. of Eli.
Yes. And I will say that this, at least to me, does give precedent that you can have a not-so-good father, or you can have a good father, and you can still make a personal choice to abandon the Lord. And so while we as parents do have a keen responsibility in raising up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you see Eli, who doesn't restrain them, and they take full license. But you see Samuel, who is giving a good example, and yet they take the same path as Eli's sons. And so just a point to make there. Yes, Brother Sam?
You know, throughout my lifetime, it's been my observation that some very faithful men and women have been faithful to the Lord. And Lord's service have lost their
Very good. Yes, important warning for us all to consider. Any additional thoughts? All right. So we kind of already discussed this, and I think the first part of the first question up there, I think we've already alluded to some applications we could make personally. And again, it's already been pointed out that the Israelites reject Samuel because his... because of his sons is one reason, but can you think of any other reason why they are rejecting Samuel?
It says he was old.
Because he's old? Yeah, very good.
If you want something that's ungodly, any reason is good enough. And I think they're just falling. You know, yes, Samuel had bad kids, but they would have grabbed anything.
Yes. And when they reject Samuel, did you have a comment? When they reject Samuel, God says they are really, what? Rejecting me. And so I think the primary reason why they reject Samuel is because they're rejecting God. They've already rejected God in their heart, and they're wanting what they want. And so we're rejecting you. You're old. You're almost at the end of your tenure. Your sons don't walk in your ways. We want a king like the nations who will be able to fight our battles for us. Now, they could look at Samuel and say, hey, you fought our battles for us. But they're rejecting God as their king. And so they want a king like the nations to fight those battles for them. Was there something additional?
That just seems to be really, really weak. Because, think about how much longer Samuel's going to be with them. Really in the background still, helping God the king.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure he's as old as they think he is.
Very good. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Isaac, really, of I'm about to die, and then he lives for however much longer. Yes, Kevin?
That sounds like a whole generation of parents that did not bother to raise their kids not to want to be like the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, what about the world would you want to be like other than slaves of sin?
Yes. Yeah, that's an ever-present danger. I think we see that depending on how you want to date the book of Revelation. We're either talking at least second generation Christians, maybe third generation Christians in some of those churches in Revelation 2 and 3. And what is a problem that kind of encompasses multiple churches? The desire to compromise. Because culture has a pull. It is trying to get them to do what they do to avoid the social rejection, and some Christians are walking in line with that. They are beginning to become more inclusive of the other gods, or maybe even the emperor worship, whatever might be involved there. And there's this pressure to compromise. There's always that pressure to compromise. And again, parents have a keen responsibility. Children have to eventually make their own decisions, as Samuel and Eli's sons needed to as well. Any additional thoughts? All right. So Samuel is upset that they are rejecting him. God says, no, they're really rejecting me. You can give them a king, but tell them exactly what a king is going to do. And what are some of the things that God tells Samuel to tell the people is going to happen to the people if they get this king of theirs?
He basically tells them the history of the kings that are coming to reign over them.
Yes.
They don't sit there and say, this is a bad idea. Let's change our minds. They double down. They're like, no, we want this.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Very good.
He's going to take more than he gives.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's going to be a big price tag associated with this king. Any other thoughts?
Welcome to the tax world.
Yeah. Very good. Yes, exactly. Was there someone else that was going to make a comment? I couldn't tell if it was two or three talking at one time. So. All right, good. We see several specifics that are issues that are discussed there. You have the draft, the taxes, the servants, possession of lands. And as Jim pointed out, we see all of these things happening throughout the history of the United and Divided Kingdom. Probably the apex of this is when you get to the house of Omri, and specifically Ahab. You see a lot of those things kind of overlapping in one person. And, of course, Jezebel has kind of pushed that along. So when we get to the Divided Kingdom, we'll kind of see some of those echoes of what God told. God, in essence, is going to, through the prophets, say, I told you so. I told you all this beforehand. You chose it. This is what you get. All right. Any additional comments or questions there on number 6? Yes, Brother Kevin?
It sounds like his blood be on us and our children.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very good. Any additional thoughts? All right. Let's go to section number 7 here. So God providentially brings what man to Samuel so that he might be anointed king of Israel? Saul. Very good. And I don't think I asked this question. Does anyone know what Saul means?
Beautiful.
It sounds pretty close to Shamuel in Hebrew. You have the sh at the beginning of Samuel in Hebrew. This is Saul is the, I think it's the passive participle, but it's asked for. And so you have Saul, they ask for a king, they get the very one that they've asked for. They get Saul, the one who has been asked for. And so God brings him. He says, they've asked for you, either providentially or, I assume providentially, probably not a name change, but providentially, the one whose name means asked for is brought to the people because they asked for him. All right? Now, what are some things you see about this man? What characteristics does Saul have, here at the beginning at least?
His head and shoulders above the rest.
Head and shoulders above the rest. That's going to come up, I think, in our next section when we talk about David and Goliath, that if the average height at that time for a male was somewhere in the low 5 foot range, and you've got Saul, who is probably 6 foot, 6.5 foot, who is head and shoulders above everybody else, who should be going out to fight the champion? It should be Saul. And he's in the tent, and then David comes in, and he's going to fight. So we'll talk about that some more. So we have head and shoulders above. That's the picture of a champion. That's the picture of a warrior. What else do you see about Saul?
Very choice and
handsome man. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, he.
At the time of his anointing, he was very humble.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yep. Yes.
Saul himself has battled like that power, so I don't think they had to David. The power was anointed Saul, whose dad was mighty man of power, his choice and answer to Saul.
Yes, very good. I think we'll see that contrast, the initial contrast between Saul, who is already head and shoulders above everybody else, handsome, mighty, and he's the one who has the look of a king. David is younger. I don't think he's a little boy, David, whenever he goes out and fights Goliath, but he is a younger man. He's not the one you anticipate because he's got this string of older brothers who are taller and look like warriors. And yet, then you have him. Now, we're still going to see these some similarities in their physical appearance, that David is also described as a handsome man. But just as kind of a preview, God looks at what? Not the outward appearance, but the heart. Looks at the heart. And so we're going to see some key contrast between the kind of king that the people ask for and the kind of king that God selects.
I think the contrast between Saul in just a moment as he hides and so forth, versus the boldness of David when he comes onto the scene, there particularly in the story of Goliath. That sometimes what looks like humility when put to pressure ends up being maybe something more like a lack of confidence or an inferiority complex, yes, or something that can really turn bitter. And then somebody who has confidence can sometimes be labeled as, arrogant or so forth. And I think that's what you see happen here, is that, Saul looks the part, he looks the part, but he is not. And then David causes all this ire because of his righteous confidence, and but the heart is really there.
Yeah, exactly. You read ahead in my notes, that's exactly where I was wanting to go with Saul. I have trouble just saying dogmatically he was a humble man at the beginning. I wonder if there's a little bit of that inferiority complex, because he's always concerned about what the people think. So the people ask for a king, and they get a king that's only concerned about what the people think. And after his first sin, and his second sin, don't abandon me, make me look good in front of the people. We're having this kind of issue where the leader of the people is the one who's going to do what the people want, not necessarily what God wants. And we'll see a contrast there with David. Any additional thoughts?
There's a biography of Winston Churchill and comparing him to the previous administration, and said the former leader led by sticking his finger in the wind, and or he led by the wind, the direction of the wind, whereas Winston Churchill led by a compass. And I think that's what you see with these two guys. You have one guy that's, as you say, seeing where the wind blows versus the other, which path is true north.
Excellent. Very good. Good illustration. Any additional thoughts?
You might summarize it as Saul was very concerned about what people thought about him, whereas David seemed to be more concerned about what people think about God.
Excellent. Yeah, we're going to really highlight that when we get to his interaction with David and Goliath. We definitely see that in his introduction. Any additional thoughts? All right. All right, then let's see if there was something I wanted to bring up. I will point out just a couple of side points here while we're in this section. Remember the story of Saul, how that he is found by Samuel. And you remember it says he was looking for the seer. What little historical note does the author of 1 Samuel give us about seer and what a seer is? The old name for a prophet. So that does imply that whenever 1 Samuel was written, it's after the time when they called him a seer. So I tend to think that Samuel and Kings are kind of written a little bit later, probably at the exile, in which they're looking back in Samuel and Kings and saying, this is why we got to where we are. And then Chronicles is going to give us another perspective and say, this is in the time of the return, this is... You see the more positive elements saying there is hope for Israel. So we're going to kind of see that pessimistic view of Samuel Kings and the more optimistic view of Chronicles. But yeah, the in former times they were called a seer. A prophet was called a seer, and here is that former time. All right. Another element here that I want to bring up, look with me in 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse 20. 1 Samuel chapter 9 and verse number 20. Right. Notice it says, as for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? Now, I want us to keep in mind that word desirable in Israel and look over in Haggai 2 and verse 7, Haggai 2. In verse 7, and I think what we have here is basically identical language, which is picking up this idea of kingship, authority, and that's what's awaiting the people in the future in the Messianic kingdom. And Haggai 2 in verse 7 says, I will shake all the nations, and they will come with the wealth of the nations, and will fill this house with glory, says the Lord of hosts. Now, the word translated wealth in Haggai, does anybody have anything different there? The wealth of all the nations? Desire of the nations? This has sometimes been viewed, mainly, I think, if I remember the history of research correctly, I think this was mainly a view that the desire of the nations is Jesus, probably since the 1600s, 1700s when the King James translated it this way. But it's almost identical language to what is desirable in Israel. And so what is desirable of the nations is now going to come into the temple. I think we're talking here about, for Saul, you're going to take possession of all the wealth of my people, as it were. And in the future, there's going to be a king who comes, and to all Israel, faithful Israel, Jews and Gentiles, all that is desired is going to come into that temple, and the glory is going to be great. So I think that we have some identical language here to show this is... Haggai is probably not talking about Jesus being the desire, but all that is desirable, all the blessings associated with the Messianic kingdom are going to come to God's people through Jesus when he comes. All right. Any additional thoughts about anything here? Yes.
The very Bible that says God doesn't look on the outward appearance, but you should look on the outward appearance. I think it's interesting that in the same book that says David was good looking, it says Saul was good looking. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very good. Yeah, several years ago, probably about 10 years ago now, I preached a lesson on the blessing and curse of beauty. Because we see that all the way through Joseph. And one of the points that kind of relates to yours is in that ancient world and just in general, I think it still should be, there could be some truth to it today as well. But why do the parents of Moses save him? Because they see he is a beautiful child. Now, sometimes we read that and it's like, oh, if he was ugly, would they have got rid of that child? No. It's symbolizing that God's providence was upon this child. He has the beauty to be a leader for the people. So I think we do see that correlation throughout, is that often the physical leaders of God's people will be handsome people. But there is often some curses associated with that. Think of Joseph and the temptation that came along with him being handsome. And there was a couple of other thoughts I had on that, but we don't have time necessarily to dive into that. Notice that Saul, God does not say, you will be a king. He will be a king, but when he self-describes him, he says, you will be a prince and a ruler of God's inheritance. So Israel is God's inheritance, and Saul is going to be kind of the manager of that. He's going to be the prince under the true king. God does not relinquish his kingship. He is still saying, you are going to be under me. And what's interesting, when we get to the New Testament, we're going to have God who has authority, who has delegated authority to Christ, and Christ is over God's inheritance, we being God's inheritance, in Ephesians chapter 1. All right, appreciate everyone's participation. You can read the challenge on your own. And what we'll do next time is start into lesson number 9.